You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked position. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. Ah, Patrick, here we are, well into the holiday season of giving. And of course, for every year for the last few years, we've been giving an opportunity of sorts into the universe in the form of a backer level for the Uncanny Magazine yearly Kickstarter.
Worthy cause.
A very worthy cause. And the third nerd backer level has been around for, oh, I don't know, like 4, maybe 5 years at this point.
And Robert's going to be pissed because he wanted it this year. He wanted it. So, and our guest beat him to it.
He did. Yeah. So faster on the trigger finger, motivated by his creative spark. We have Jordan Marshall, who is our third nerd for 2025. Welcome aboard, Jordan.
Thank you. I'm really excited to get to be a part of this.
So you have a particular creative enterprise you're embroiled in right now.
We got to pay homage here. Tell us how much you love Uncanny Magazine.
Oh, so much.
Come on, Space Unicorn.
I know, right? I have actually, it's funny, I recently put my fridge sticker up, and the people I'm living with are like, what's this like Space Unicorn thing? And I'm like, you don't even know. But I ran into them because they often will do, you know, a so-and-so destroys, speculative fiction. And I ran into them when I think they did their issue on queers destroy fiction. And it just, not only do they always attract the best writers just broadly, but their commitment to really empowering people who have traditionally not been represented in speculative fiction is just so wonderful. So yeah, they're one of my favorites.
Ours as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that commitment and curiosity about the voices of those who haven't always had a seat at the table is part of the creative work that you've been engaged in.
Yeah. So, I guess. Yeah. Is that, or have we done enough to move on? Yeah. Currently, I'm working with a group of friends. We actually are just now in the process of renaming our studio because we had hastily named it and then I was like, no, I don't like that. So we're renaming. So just a untitled group of game writers. But we're writing a tabletop RPG called We Begin at Midnight, which is about you take on the role of a coven of witches collected around sort of a certain type of mission, whether it's protecting a neighborhood or hunting monsters or trying to protect the political process from undue manipulation. And based on the kind of coven you decide to do, you essentially engage in those kinds of missions to fight for social justice. But luckily you have magic. So it's a little bit, easier for you. So.
Yeah, I'm probably dating myself here a little bit because I'm very much a gaming child of the 90s. But it's kind of giving a little like spiritual successor to White Wolf Studios' focus on specific kind of realms of uncanny creatures. You know, they had werewolf, they had vampire, they had mage, they had wraith, and so on and so on. But I'm sure that your approach to it is you're looking for your own distinctive voice and you have a different approach in its own way.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly all of us in the group played White Wolf games. Mm-hmm. I've played Vampire, I've played Mage, done a little Werewolf. And actually, the college we went to, we were in a like ongoing Vampire LARP. And what was funny was that because several of us either were in student government or worked for the building of our student union, we actually hosted it in our student union on Saturday nights.
Nice.
And so, yeah, I did a multi-year Vampire the Masquerade a LARP. So I'm definitely familiar with White Wolf. And I would agree with you. One of our things, though, I think, is we are trying to, I think, do more of the, I think, like, traditional urban fantasy where there's a mashup. So, like, yes, there are these distinct versions, but they're all sort of colliding together, as opposed to, like, playing vampire, in which, like, vampires are primarily the supernaturals you're running into.
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned that you're sort of formed a studio with these friends, and also in the sort of green room time before we got set up here, Patrick very excitedly told you about his love of tabletop role-playing games. And you said, well, that's great that you're a consumer of tabletop role-playing games, because I basically have a degree in making them. And so as a resident nerd of the academic variety here, my spider sense went, woo. So when you say that you have like a degree in making tabletop role-playing games, what does that actually like mean? Like, what does that involve for you?
Yeah, so my I double majored in undergrad. I won super traditional political science, and then at our university we had a degree called Emerging Media and Digital Art, and it really was this hodgepodge of professors. You know, there were music people, like one professor had a PhD from Berkeley's Experimental Sound Lab. My advisor had a PhD in 19th century literature. There was just all kinds of people there. And I basically split my time between, it was all from a media studies perspective, but half the time was game design. And so I focused on tabletop, and then half was essentially speculative world building. So I was in like transmedia storytelling classes, world building classes. I got to take classes on like cybernetics and cyber culture, and then game design. And then, you know, to connect us all together, we did like classes in digital audio, digital visual. That was kind of the underlying to give everyone a sort of sense of practice, I guess.
That's awesome.
And then one of the other ones, I mean, like, we were all close friends before, but then one of our other designers has a master's in communication. He also really focused on tabletop role-playing games as well in his academic studies. So we have a lot of academic focus on games, as well as all being lifelong tabletop players.
So I'm just curious, like when you're talking about you're building this game, are you building it on like an existing system? Are you trying to create your own system? Like, is this going to be like a D20 system, a D12 system? Like, what are you doing?
Absolutely. So, we started with original conception was I love witches. Like, I love all, you know, I did Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Craft, Practical Magic. I read lots of different genres, everything from, you know, witch cozy mysteries to you know, Agatha All Along from Disney.
Did you watch that show that was on Freeform?
Yes.
Loved that show.
The Fort, the Salem. Something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I love
that all about
show.
Like their like vocalization. Yeah.
Yes.
Very interesting.
Fucking awesome.
So yeah, I even watched the like bad, The Circle, that was by from like written by the same author who got taken advantage of from the Vampire Diaries. I did. Yeah. Anyway, love witches. So, and so initially it was like, oh, let's play a game. Well, like, let's write a game where you can just like be all kinds of different witches. And I think as designers, we came to realize that when you try and like do everything, that's not very good design. It's like, let's, you know, you can be every kind of witch. It's like, well, you know, a witch in a like cozy coastal mystery is very different from, you know, one who's, I don't know, fighting the forces of darkness and is like in a very grim, you know, white wolf oppressive setting. And so we chose, there's a game called Blades in the Dark. Yeah.
So, you're speaking his language now.
Yeah, right. So we chose that. It has a nice, initially, that was like kind of building on that, I would say, framework, the nice moving between missions and downtime in a really nice circle. So I would say that like loosely we've been that, but it has gotten a ton of our own stuff put on there and our own emphasis. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, it does use those systems. You roll 2d6, things are expressed through like threat roles. You have, you know, stats are kind of called actions rather than like more traditional stats. So yeah, I think that that's where we started with, and it has now become our own monster.
Yeah. Our last guest that we had on, being that she's an author, I asked her about the whole idea of writing the book that you wish you could read. And so obviously with your love of witches, you're trying to craft with your partners in the form of We Begin at Midnight, the working title of your game system here. You're trying to craft the game that you would want to play. But I'm also kind of curious, since you've played lots of games, like what are some of the experiences of gameplay that you knew you wanted to avoid? Like that you have found in some way frustrating or less than rewarding, that you're like, we want to give our players something that won't take them to these places or won't give them these frustrations.
And it's okay if you throw Pathfinder Second Edition Witch class under the bus, because I was reading about it actually just last night, not even knowing that that's what your game was about. But I was reading the Witch class last night going, I don't think that I like this.
Right. Oh my gosh, that's a great question. And you just exploded my brain.
We can table it and return to it later.
No, exploding dice.
I love that question. I'll just give a couple of examples. So tarot is a big theme for our, tarot's in lots of witch media. So we've really brought it in, and essentially that's the way our witches do magic is there's these, we took the major arcana and we kind of just like named some qualities for each one and then had some oppositional qualities, and that's how they do their magic. So if like you have, like one of the things we said, like if you have the fool, we call it their magic embers, but if you have the fool ember, like one of the things fool's rules are doors. So you have magic over doors, but oppositionally, fools cannot engage in imprisonment. That's antithetical to fool magic. And so, for instance, like you can have power over doors, but you could never lock someone in a room with fool magic because they cannot imprison. It just doesn't work. Hmm. So we've been using the tarot a lot. And one of the things that we wanted to ask people was, a lot of times in role-playing games, you know, you get like experience points or however you talk about like character progression. And it is often abstracted from the experience of play or from your character. You know, you're going along at some point you get some XP and you can buy a new, you know, you can get new spell levels if you're playing a wizard, or you get a new feat or whatever it is in any game. You know, in Vampire, you can mark a new level of a discipline on your vampire. And we didn't want character progression to be an abstraction from the experience of play. So instead we had, when you go to buy a new power or do, you know, to progress your character, we have you draw a tarot card or roll on a table. You know, we don't expect people to have to actually have the little deck. And there's a question, and it might be something like, you know, recently your character avoided interfering in a situation and you now have regretted not taking action. What does your character do to cope with this growing sadness about not acting? And so we wanted this idea that as you progress, you're thinking about how your character is changing. Like you're becoming more powerful, but what is it to become more powerful? You know, what is it? Because like inevitably you're also probably then fighting more injustice. And so what is that like? We didn't want people to not have to think about what it is to gain more powers or more experience. And that was really important to us.
So more character development.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to signal to players this, at least from our perspective, this is what a character progression is, to ask these kinds of questions, to not just like assume that you may know, and then instead provide guidance for that. So I think that that was something that was important to us, was to really emphasize that getting XP should mean character growth.
Yeah. Not just power, not just, yeah. new gear, new spells. Yeah, that's not, that's something that not a lot of, I feel like that is something that is kind of come out of the Critical Role influence mm-hmm. on gaming. It's like developing your characters, because not everyone does that. Like they just, especially, and I know that I throw 5e under the bus quite a bit, but 5e tends to be just attack, 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 hack, slash, hack, slash, hack, slash. And so a lot of times you get players that that's all they want to do. They just want to hack and slash and do more and more and more damage. And they don't necessarily think about their character and kind of having those character moments. So that's really cool that you're focusing on that as part of the system itself and promoting that.
Yeah, I think systems that are principally combat focused, like most of their mechanics are just about what are the consequences of character action in a combat context.
That's why we have mega dungeons. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like that you could get a module that's just like, here's the next 6 months of gameplay that you can do and you'll never see the light of day during the course of it. On the one hand, there's nothing that like prevents people from exploring character growth in those. But to some degree, it kind of abdicates the responsibility for deciding if character growth and things are going to be of interest to that table group, to the table group itself, and says, like, look, make that a house rule thing, or like just decide amongst yourselves if the ethos of your table is character development and growth and narrative and whatever. And if it's not, then whatever, here you go, you got a pile of murder rules. And then there are other systems that I think try to bake into how the game itself functions, what characterization, what character growth looks like and means and its implications moving forward. And I think other than the fact that obviously that's like an assistive mechanism for that process, the other interesting thing that it does, though, is you can't pick up that book or like the future book, for instance, for We Begin at Midnight, read through that rule system and its descriptions and be confused about what the vibe of the game is, right? Like, it's advertising to you in its design. Like, you need to be the kind of player and the kind of game master who's down for this. Whereas I think other things are a little bit more vibe agnostic, where it's like, here's a system. I don't know, man. Do what you're going to do. And that kind of says
to me, min-max.
Potentially, yeah. And so getting back to Jordan here, this kind of says to me that you and your creative team are wanting to make really clear to your audience that they are your audience and what you're wanting them to do with you and engage with.
Absolutely. And that's been a big part of our a lot of our conversations are, you know, what is the audience going to do with this? Will they get what we're putting down? And you know, one of the constant questions, I think a lot of designers go through this, which is, are they going to like this or not? What if they don't? And eventually, you mentioned earlier, right, you know, writing the novel you always wished you could read. And in our case, designing the game that we always wanted and making the decision that, like, well, we are putting this emphasis on more sort of emotional consequences or political consequences of the sense of like, what is it to fight against powerful institutions that are oppressing us, and hoping that people pick that up. But, you know, ultimately, if someone picks up this game and they try and do a dungeon crawl with it, like, we're not putting a lot there for them. It's their choice. But hoping that we do find that group of people who are really into trying to explore some of these more character-driven kinds of questions. You know, one of the things about our game is that a lot of actions are adjudicated by threat roles. And one of the things is that basically we've argued that you don't really fail a role. There's not, like, in a binary sense, right? Like, in D&D, you can, like, fail the climb role, right? And then you don't climb up, you don't climb the rope, like, and then you sort of like move on. In ours, there's no way in which you're going to If you say like, oh, I'm going to try and scramble up this wall, you're always going to do that. Instead, a lot of times the consequences of rolls are more depending on how good you are. The story, the GM is going to try and create a spectrum of consequence. So it's like, oh, you're always going to go get up there. But in a really, if you roll really poorly, you get up there, but you then run into the vampire you've been trying to avoid, you know, who you'd pissed off last week, and he's up there, right? But and a really good roll then is like, yeah, you totally scramble up there, and also you spot the coming patrol before they spot you. And I think that, like, not just for us, an emphasis on like social justice, which is important to our game, but also just like, what have we learned about what is good story? What are interesting stories?
Yeah.
You know, I don't always, I think, you know, oftentimes, like, sometimes, yes, it is interesting in a novel when the person fails at what they're doing, but like oftentimes, like, they're getting where they're going. It's the complications that make something interesting. If a story was just like, and Robin went to you know, scale the building and didn't, and he just fell on his butt, like, we wouldn't really be interested in reading that comic, right? Like, or that story.
Well, then he takes bludgeoning damage, so.
Right, yeah. But
yeah, and to that point, like, there's so much... There's an argument to be made, like, well, of course, it's not realistic that your character would always get up to the top of the rope. Be like, it's a freaking witch's game. Like, how much realism is it? Like, is that really what we signed up for here? The idea right. that you can introduce struggle into the character experience where not everything is a gimme, where the struggle isn't just, can I get up the wall? The struggle is actually something more about the kind of like, okay, you're up on top of the wall, but now you didn't realize there was a guard on the other side. And so now we can give people the feeling of success over stuff where failure would feel kind of like needlessly cheap and minor, but still introduce challenges.
Here's where my brain has been since you mentioned it, Jordan. Asking the question of like, how does this impact your character? Like, what changes? And it forces the player to look at their character in a new way that a lot of games don't. And I've been having this conversation with some friends because we've all gotten Daggerheart. Because the bandwagon was driving by, we all jumped on, and right. I am on the fence about Daggerheart. I think that it can create a problem for introverted people. If you're very introverted and you're getting into these games, and like, you can sit down at a table and you can play 5e. And you can be introverted and play 5e and you're going to be fine. Same thing with Pathfinder. Same thing with a lot of other games. If you sit down at Daggerheart and you're very introverted and the spotlight comes on you and it's now you have to move the story forward, you're going to struggle. Mm-hmm. You're going to struggle a lot. And having this mechanic or whatever we want to call it, I'm calling it mechanic because it sounds like a mechanic, where when you level up, what's the impact to your character? That gets you into this storytelling mode with your character. And you're going to think up some stuff and you're going to be like, mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay. You know, it's almost like a writing prompt for them.
You try to teach a player how to think about their character.
Yeah. Right. And then what I can see happening is this player is going to be like, oh, well, you know, leveling up, they get this new power and it impacts them like this and it changes this and it changes their perception. And then there's going to be something that they want to say as their character. There's going to be something, they're going to want to change how their character's acting. And that's going to bring them out a little bit. And they're going to actually do the role play part of role playing games, which I always feel is if you get the right group of people who all happen to be Hollywood voice actors, then yes, they're going to be really good at the role play part and they're going to be really good at the improv part. But, you know, and even the theater kids are going to be really good at the improv part. It's the rest of us that we are like deer in headlights sometimes when the spotlight hits us. And like, we don't know what to do. Or we don't know what to say. But I think like having that prompt as part of the mechanic of the game, it's like, think about your character. I know Pathfinder 2nd Edition does this. I think 5e does this as well. I'm not 100% sure. But they're like, don't start with the class you want. Don't start with the ancestry you want. Don't start with – think about a concept. What's the concept of your character and move from there? And but what I think happens is most people ignore that. Then they go, ooh, ranger, pointy, pointy, stabby, stabby. I get to shoot things, you know. And that's where they start. And then when it comes to the role play part, they don't really know, other than Aragorn, what they're going to do as a ranger, right? Yes. So I just like the idea of this constant reminder every time you level up of how is this impacting your character? What is changing about them? Is anything changing about them? Like, I really like that as a mechanic.
Well, and in our game, the phase that gets adjudicated – right now it's called Coven Time. That is a placeholder. Okay. But that section of the game, there's other things you can do. So like, that's where you answer the progress cards, but you also have different prompts where, like, and we call them vignettes, and they're essentially these like small little moments that you sort of narrate what's happening with your character. And some of the prompts are like, in the last mission, did your character, were you frustrated with what someone did? Like, in our group, when we've play tested, like, we have, a spectrum of one friend who's, you know, he's a classic, like, you know, burn the vampires down, like, you know, boots in. And we have someone else who's like way more cautious. And so we address, like, you know, if they did something that was potentially dangerous, have your character address that fictionally. And then we also have, we have a system called conditions. So one of the things that I can do for a bad roll is I can put a condition on you. And it's everything from your character's become enraged, to your character's been injured, to you've been like blighted by a malevolent magical presence. And when you gain that condition, it changes fictionally what your character is able to do, but it's in this coven time that you have to run a vignette to get rid of it. And we talk about, like, for instance, injured, we're like, okay, look, you're witches, you got healing, like, you know, other people with super powerful magic. We're not going to make you role play going to a hospital. That's just not something that's happening for you. Instead, what are the consequences of being a person who's chronically being injured? Like, if you're monster hunters and you're getting you're getting bites taken out of you, or you're getting slashed up or whatever, what are the emotional consequences of being in that kind of chronic pain and being healed and sent back out? I always go back to, I was a big fan of the rebooted Battlestar Galactica, and one of the things they explored was like, oh, well, the Cylons, like, they're immortal. They just download into a new body. But when they start getting into super violence, they start talking about, like, what is the consequence of experiencing these horrific things and then just being regenerated over and over? And so, like, that was something we wanted to deal with, is like, what are the classic things? It's like, oh, you get cursed. Now deal with, like, what is it to have to go and find someone to break this curse on you? You know, what is it to experience these things we put our characters through, and ask the players to tell us what's the consequences for them? It's not hard to deal with. We just say you run the vignette and you get rid of the condition, but you have to tell us what it was like.
Mm-hmm. As a fan of Supernatural, it just means drinking a lot of beer, yeah, and eating pie.
And shedding a single man tear, you know, last two minutes.
And then eating a lot of
pie. And all the emotional consequence gets dealt with.
And also angels are dicks.
Yes. I'm a big Supernatural fan, so yeah.
So in thinking about, like, that idea of character as concept, like, think about the concept first. I'm curious, because when the word witches gets used, depending on how people want to conceptualize it, gender it plays different roles. And so there are definitely conceptualizations of witches where witches are feminine by nature and femme-coded only, or witch is a universal term that's irrespective of gender, or
Yeah,
and so on. Yeah. And so I'm interested in, you know, we're thinking about the diversity of play options and things that could exist in We Begin at Midnight. Let's talk about gender. Like, what's going on with gender as a construct for player characters?
Sure. Well, I would agree. I think that, like, very traditionally, like, yes, absolutely, witches are femme-coded, right? And I think that going, you know, I think The Craft is a really great example, right? You know, this expression of what is it like to be, you know, girls in high school, and then, you know, and the directors talked about, and then, like, being given this power and what do you do with it? And a lot of the things they face are, like, from the bullying to, you know, the, like, shitty misogynistic boyfriends. Like, that's what they're dealing with. And then I think, you know, broadly, we see more of an opening up. In ours, I would definitely say that we come from a very, like, not explicitly, but definitely implicitly, like, queer perspective on gender. And I think, like, an understanding of witchcraft that's very the same, which is the sort of existing in between the stratified structures of society. I think we've come from a very, like, that oppression comes from these overarching structures, and, like, strict ideas of gender roles definitely are a part of that, like, system of oppression. And so, you know, not explicitly, but we're kind of like, well, witches are queer, basically, and have sort of that interpretation of gender being sort of socially constructed, and it, you know, existing in between the margins of that, being trans, being queer. So I think that, like, that would definitely be our perspective. Actually, funny, one of our designers is a PhD candidate, and their research is on how gender and gender marking is a form of social infrastructure, and how, like, it upholds our society, and yet in itself is, like, very fragile when examined very closely. So talk about, like, bringing that academic piece. Like, for us, I think that, like, that's kind of where we would sit on the expression of gender.
That's cool.
No, yeah. And one of the things that being in social justice, you know, characters, like, there are no turf witches. like witches can't be Nazis. Like, you know, we've very much taken that. So sort of an ontological, like, they just can't do it. You can't play a bad witch in our setting.
Well, in the same way that, like, if we have the Ember of the Fool, and it functions with a certain way, but also with certain, like, conceptual philosophical restrictions to it, then if you extend that outward, if there's an ethos to what it means to be a witch, then there you go. It's you've sort of baked it into the system.
Yeah.
Right, right. Well, there's, like, a million more things that we could talk about here, particularly if...
Oh, I'll talk all day and night about TTRPGs.
Right, but we probably need to exercise a tiny bit of self-discipline and try our picks of the week.
Alrighty.
Picks of the week. We'll get to picks of the week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, picks of the week.
All right. So, Patrick, what is your pick?
It's the holiday season, and that means that it's the drink as much eggnog as you physically can without vomiting season for me. And my favorite, my absolute favorite is Southern Comfort.
Ooh.
And I love it. I actually do force myself not to buy as much of it as I would like. But yeah, Southern Comfort. And I am, I do non-alcoholic. I don't drink alcohol. But I just love it, the Southern Comfort brand. It's just, it's so good. It is just so good. And I usually get what's the tall one? Is that pints?
It's probably quart.
A quart? Dang. You sure it's not a pint?
No. I didn't want it to be, but
I usually get a couple of those and nurse them during this time. And I've got one right now in the fridge. It's unopened. I finished one. I've got the other one.
By nurse them, you mean you're going to consume enough of it that you'll end up in the emergency room. That's what I'm hearing.
If I could, I would. I just love eggnog. I really do. I've always loved eggnog. And I I've told the story before, my aunt in Chicago got tired of all of us kids running around screaming at Christmas time. And so she actually spiked the kids' eggnog to put
Dang.
Us out. Wow.
She done play.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So eggnog, I just love it. And Southern Comfort is my favorite. So Southern Comfort eggnog, if you can find it in your store, I recommend highly that you buy 6 to 8 quarts.
Tis the season.
That's funny you say that, because I'm in Oregon, and we have a state dairy consortium called Umpqua. And so we drink Umpqua eggnog.
Okay.
We have a lot of different dairy, you know, agriculture here. And so, or there's another one that, you know, it's funny hearing like Southern Comfort. I'm like, they do an eggnog? Like, I don't think I've ever seen that in our grocery store.
Yeah, it's a non-alcoholic one. It's just in the dairy case with normal things. But yeah.
It's so good. It's so good. Yeah. It's in the paper milk carton thing, with the little twisty thing on it, but it's all dark, but it's got the Southern Comfort logo and stuff on there. And it's just, it's so good. It's so good.
Well, hard to top that, but Jordan, how about you?
Wow. Yeah. I'm not sure. I think, my pick would be, I'll go drink wise, a London Fog.
Oh, those are nice.
Yeah. But, you know, it gets cold, cause I'm definitely one of those people who drinks mostly cold things sort of year round, but it's finally gotten cold enough that I can get into London Fogs. I love, I of course was one of those kids. I had to try Earl Grey because of Captain Picard.
Oh yeah. Tea. Mm-hmm. Earl Grey.
You know, and then definitely like making it the first time and drinking it, being like, how can you just drink this plain? So I'm definitely a cream and sugar person.
I am as well. Yep.
But then
heathens.
I love.
We're heathens.
Yeah. And that actually, we just discovered a new cafe locally, and they actually do a full range of tea lattes. They don't just do London Fogs. You can get a whole range of their teas in latte form made right there. So I think that's my pick of the week, beverage wise.
Nice. London Fog is a very solid choice.
I will throw out the first time I ever heard of this was from my mom. So my mom was from Kentucky. She grew up with you poured Dr. Pepper in a saucepan and you heated it up, and that was your winter drink. And it was like a thing. Like Dr. Pepper advertised this. This was a thing that you were supposed to do. Like, you would heat up the Dr. Pepper in the winter and have a nice warm Dr. Pepper.
I think that's like one of those things that you shouldn't put in the internet to know for a while.
Oh, it's out there now. Like people, like I come across the video and then like people used to do this. It's like, yeah, my mom talked about that. Like she did that when she was a kid. Yeah. It's crazy. Anyway, Tracy.
So I feel kind of bad in that I do have a food based pick here, but it's like an anti pick. We've talked before. There's evil Santa as a construct in the Townsend household, which is, you know, our sort of general belief that the universe creates its own kind of stability through, if there's a good Santa who brings you stuff you want, there's an evil Santa who brings you completely cursed, unhinged shit that you don't want.
Buy it.
And, you know, that's, I mean, to be honest with you, there have been some years where we've put more effort into each other's evil Santa gift giving than each other's like sincere Santa gift giving. But because you have to be a certain kind of deranged to get pleasure out of that sort of thing. So this is sort of an anti-pick in the sense that if you're the kind of person who goes to the party and brings something to people and is like, you've got to try this because I think you're going to hate it, buckle up, buttercup, because this one's for you. It's on my mind because holiday season, as we've mentioned, but one of the many evil uncles in Shea Townsend is a guy named George. And George has a grandfather who is particularly fond of this candy. And every year, George buys some of it to give to his grandfather, who eats it eagerly and sincerely. And when he told us the name of this candy and the backstory behind it one day, we were like, George, no, you're lying. This can't possibly be true. This is just no one, what? And he was like, no, it's true. And so the next time he came over for game night, sure enough, George brought a bag of G-Shaft. So this candy, you might be wondering, like, what on earth is the deal with it? If you were to go to danshomemadecandies.com, spelled as you would expect, you would find a candy business that's based in Joliet, Illinois, home of the Blues Brothers. And it is not perhaps the best thing to have come out of Joliet, Illinois. So the backstory on G-Shaft runs like this. There's a woman whose husband works for the mining company out in Braidwood back in 1877. And there is a mine shaft collapse that ends up killing him, leaving her widowed with many small mouths to feed and no method of income. So she ends up making in her kitchen, using a family recipe, a hard candy that she decides to call G-Shaft, named after the mine collapse that killed her husband. Wow. She then takes G-Shaft to local businesses which sell it on her behalf. If you were to try G-Shaft, the only reasonable conclusion you could reach is that the sellers here told this story to the people who bought the candy, and they bought it purely out of pity. So you go to danshomemadecandies.com and you search up some G-Shaft. One thing, you'll find out it's dirt cheap, and I'll tell you why. When I brought a bag of G-Shaft to my colleagues at the IMSA English department, who were also like, bullshit, this candy doesn't exist. What are you even talking about? They had a taste testing, and we got the following feedback. It tastes like childhood, as in the childhood of a Victorian chimney sweep. It's like a Ricola soaked in Malort.
Ricola.
It's minty with a hint of kerosene on the nose. I didn't know that pain had a flavor. And so forth. So if you were to buy a bag of G-Shaft, it comes in half pound and pound varieties. You can get it sent to your very own home. Do you want this for yourself? No. No sane person wants this for themselves. But is it worth spending $4 to get an 8-ounce bag of it to give to someone who's a frenemy? Oh, it's very worth it. And just watch. Just watch and make sure you have your iPhone camera on. Make sure you let people know this holiday season that you definitely don't love them with some G-Shaft.
Oh my gosh.
It sort of seems on point with, like, you could imagine this having come out of a witch's cauldron and the sense of it. Yeah. Like the bad witches that don't exist in your game would make G-Shaft.
Or as a punishment to bad people.
Right. Yeah, you violated the code and now you get the shaft.
This heinous candy. It tastes like despair.
It's 100% an experience.
Meanwhile, on the Irish Try Channel on Friday, they were trying Indonesian flavored drinks. Okay. And this was basically like, you know, the little squirt things that we have that you can squirt in the water.
So you got like durian or whatnot? Or
that was the last one. And it was hilarious to see they tried like jackfruit. They tried another one. They tried another one. And then they brought out the durian. And you want to talk about people who have been traumatized by durian. Triers have been traumatized by durian, and none of them were happy about this. I think at that point, they would have retried Malort rather than having to try the durian flavored drink.
Same. Although jackfruit's kind of fun. It's sort of like a pineapple and a banana had a baby.
They did not care for it at all. They thought.
Well, I've never had artificial jackfruit squeezy stuff. So
I mean, like in concentrate form.
Yeah, but I've had actual jackfruit.
I think the jackfruit they said was like medicine-y. It was like a medicine.
Well, I've seen those, and it's really funny seeing people from like all over the British Isles when they have root beer for the first time.
Yeah.
Because they all are like, it's like toothpaste. And I'm like, first of all, what are you putting in your toothpaste? That root beer is like, this is like toothpaste. But then it's funny when some of them are like, no, I've been to America, and they like put ice cream in this. I'm like, dude, it's so sad you don't grow up with root beer floats.
I know, right?
That's my favorite.
Also, I mean, to be honest, you could put ice cream in like a shoe and I would be like, it's fine now. It wasn't at the bottom of the dumpster, that shoe.
You could put ice cream in your hot Dr. Pepper.
I guess that's
a
thing that we could do.
I will throw out, there's another one. There's another channel that I've recently discovered called Cocoa Butter.
Okay.
And this
No, I know what you're talking about. It's sort of like somebody cooks a plate of food and then other people eat it. And it's often like black cooks and white cooks and so on.
Or Italian and Mexican cooks. And one of the recent ones that I watched that I enjoyed was fish and chips, American versus British. Fish and chips. And that was a good one. But yeah, that's essentially what it is. It's like, there's like four people and all four of them make their version of the dish. And then, you know, three people try and then they vote on it and they give points. And then the winner at the end gets to win. And they had one, what's her name? Leslie from, she used to be on SNL.
She was doing the fried chicken one.
She did the fried chicken one. Yeah. And she's like, nah, get the shit out of here. Nah. She's just like, get it away from me. This is garbage. What's wrong with you? What happened to you? Why would you cook this?
What I love about that channel is like, they're all convinced they're doing the best version of it.
Yes.
And it's really then funny to be like, no, this is like, no one can doubt me. And then everyone else is just like, what is this?
It's terrible. I saw one of the episodes. It was like captured on a Reels thing on Facebook or something. I saw part of an episode and it was like Thanksgiving plates. Here are some black families and here are some white families, Thanksgiving plates. And they put one of the black cooks plates in front of like the solo white lady who was there, who had a little bit of a sort of Brooklyn Jewish kind of twang going on. It was sort of charming. And she's like, oh, look, they've got carrots.
Carrots. Yep. Yep.
And it's like, oh, no.
Oh, no.
No, that's not carrots. And everybody else is like, oh, the yams is pretty good. Yeah, and you know, checking it out and whatnot. And she's like, I don't think these are carrots.
That's amazing. Lord.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So I think with that conversation about like good and wholesome reflections on food, we have purged the ghost of G-Shaft, which is fun. Jordan, your project and your working team sound like they are great things for you to have and to be involved in. So where should people go if they want to keep up to date on the future of We Begin at Midnight?
It's funny you should say that. We're not yet able to take on people. This is we're still so preliminary that we've been neglectful in setting up our sending people things. So your podcast has given us the motivation to like get our sign up for our newsletter set up.
Good. So, nice. You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah. Well, when you do have it all set up, send it to me and we'll push it out on social.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's been great talking about it. All
right. Well, thank you for joining us, Jordan.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. Thank you for supporting Uncanny.
Absolutely.
This is great.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, And that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.